Okay, so for today, I want to present to you boys on a very fundamental topic in terms of what it means to not only be a human being, but what it means to be a frum yid. I like to come in a couple times a year and just touch on some of these topics. I'm sure your Rebbe has touched on this topic multiple times based on the different topics that have come up in the Gemara and the Parsha, etc. But I want to just spend a few minutes today really focusing on this topic. The topic basically, if we could title it with one word, would be emuna. Who here thinks they know what the word emuna means?
Belief.
Belief. Any other ideas? Yeah.
Faith.
Faith.
Trust.
Trust. So we had actually recently in the parsha the same shorash of emuna, emun, and it refers to being a trusted servant, trustworthiness. Emuna means that we connect to the Ribono Shalom, to Hashem, to Yiddishkeit, with a trustworthiness. And it's interesting how you would divide that between Emuna and Bitachon. The Chazon Ish has a whole sefer on that. But focusing on Emuna, it means that we have a certain, not faith like blind leap of faith, not belief like we have to just do it even though it makes no sense to us, even though it seems nonsensical. No. Emuna is trustworthy. It's trustworthy. And there are many different ways of arriving at that sense of emuna. Some of you might have what we call emuna pshuta. Some people say that emuna pshuta means I don't think about it at all. I just walk around and I never think about Yiddishkeit. Is there Hashem or not? I don't think about such things ever. As if pashut in that phrase, emuna pshuta, means simple, almost childish. But that's not, the Rishonim tell us, that's not how they use the phrase emuna pshuta at all. What does the word pashut mean?
Obvious.
So simple can have different connotations. Obvious is a good one, right? It could also mean straight. Okay, it can mean straight, it's very clear. Emuna pshuta is not someone who's mindless and thoughtless. Oh, he has emuna pshuta. He actually might have no emuna. He might be a frum Jew. There are people who could be a frum Jew and they think not at all about who they are or what they are or what significance it has. That's not emuna pshuta, that's pretty much no emuna. You're just going through the motions. Emuna pshuta is something along the lines of, you look out at the world, and it's like obvious there's a Ribono Shalom. Someone comes to you and says, well, maybe it's all an accident. You're like, what? That's crazy. I'm not even going to waste my brain cells on that. That's Emuna Pshuta. It's so obvious. You know, one of the masters of Emuna Pshuta? Recently, we had a great gadol, Rav Avigdor Miller. Who here has heard of Rav Avigdor Miller? Rav Avigdor Miller was a master at every little tiny thing in the world. The Ribono Shalom is so obviously there. He could spend 45 minutes talking about one vein in one leaf that fell off a tree. The godless of Hashem from that. And then, of course, in our bodies and in the whole creation, it's pashut, it's pshita, it's obvious, there's a Ribono Shalom. And for many people, that's it. And that's a very powerful emuna. And that's an appropriate emuna. Rabbi Shapiro actually was just telling me recently that he was walking down the street with Rabbi Avigdor Miller when he was in his 20s in Brooklyn. And there were a bunch of Bachrim there asking Rabbi Avigdor Miller, Shilas, what's the halakha in this case? What does Rabbi think is the right thing to do in that case? And each time they were walking, it was a cold winter night in Brooklyn, and they were walking on the sidewalk and he was answering their questions. And Rabbi Shapiro says, in between questions, there was always 5, 10, 15 seconds where there would be a lull in the conversation. It would be the next person's turn to now think of what's the next question we're going to ask this great Rav. Rabbi Shapiro remembers every time there was a lull in the conversation, Rabbi Avigdor Miller, instead of just walking quietly waiting for the next question, would immediately say, now let's go back to the sugya of the night. We're walking in cool, crisp air. Thank you, Ribono Shel Olam. Look at the magnificent trees you've provided us as we pass them. The fresh air is so delicious in my love. And he would just go, and then someone would say, can I ask the Rebbe a question? And then they go to the next question, and he'd always come back to that. There was no room for just walking quietly. It was always just mesmerized by the godless of Hashem. That was Rebbe Victor Miller. And that's deep thinking, complex, emunah pshuta. What I want to present to you today are some basic rational ideas, logical ideas, that for those of you that feel like you have that emunah pshuta with thought, this will strengthen your emunah. For those of you that feel like, I don't know if I have so much of that, well then this can certainly give you a platform for tremendous emunah. So here are the ideas that I want to share with you. Let's start like this. Who here thinks, raise your hand, that there was a man named George Washington who was a general in the Revolutionary War? You were very hesitant to raise your hand there, and you're not raising your hand. All right, so what do you say? You are raising your hand? So generally speaking, people will say that's historical fact, not fiction. It's not a story, it's not a fairy tale. It's truth, it's fact. Whereas, did George Washington chop down a cherry tree?
No.
Maybe yes, maybe no. We don't have what we call the evidence to support it, and therefore we'll call that historical fiction.
We don't know.
Well, we relegate it to fiction unless we establish it as fact. But yeah, it could have, anything could have happened, but we don't call something historical fact unless we have a certain amount of evidence to support it. We have that evidence that George Washington was the general in the Revolutionary War. So my question to you is, what's the strength of that evidence? After all, you have a signed document from him? Maybe I signed it right now and I'm showing it to you. Maybe somebody back in that day when he was alive, or he was never alive, let's say, just signed the name George Washington, but there was never any such person, and now we have that document that has that signature. We have a coin, we have a dollar bill with his face on it. Anybody can make any piece of art anytime they want. What really is the strength? The strength lies, and this will be accepted by historians, the greatest, and in courtrooms, even till this day, the greatest strength is eyewitness account. We have multiple different families, all who witnessed, they say, they witnessed George Washington. We don't have any of those people alive nowadays. They told their children, who told their children, who told their children, and maybe some of those people are alive nowadays, 3-4 steps. And those people tell us, we have passed down from generation to generation an eyewitness account that there was a man named George Washington and he was a general in the Revolutionary Army. We do not have such eyewitness accounts of him chopping down a cherry tree. We find stories of mothers putting their children to sleep and talking about that and being honest and other things like that. So we say that's historical fiction because we don't have the eyewitness historical accounts. Whereas we call it historical fact when we do have that passed down eyewitness account. Yes, Rabbi.
Rabbi Landa. When Rabbi Landa comes in, I always like to challenge him.
Please, I appreciate the challenge.
To get the juices going.
Absolutely.
So let's go with what you're saying, and let's say that, and I'm going to jump ahead just a step or two and say.
Let me develop it then. Let me develop it.
Yeah, but I want you to, as you're saying it, I want you to think about this, and I want the boys to think about it as well. You don't have to give an answer now.
Mm-hmm.
The question I want to ask is, so there was an Avraham Avinu, and he discovered Hashem. But who says he chopped down the idols? That's the question.
Okay.
Because I'm just taking your George Washington story.
Absolutely.
And I'm saying,
absolutely.
I'll believe in Avraham Avinu. But who says that he chopped down the cherry tree?
Good question. We'll address that question coming up. Okay, good question. Good getting the juices going here, flowing. Here we go. So, that's the way we establish historical facts from fiction. Primarily, the best way, if we have not just one, but multiple eyewitness accounts passed down to us generation to generation till this day. Now you might be thinking to yourself, that's not as good of a proof as I can touch this desk right here and know that it exists because with my five senses right now I can detect it. I can see it, I can touch it, I can hear it, I can taste it and smell it if I wanted to. I can use my five senses to detect things right now. Everything in history is not detectable through your five senses. It's only detectable through your analysis of your brain. Because anything that was only in the past, you can't detect it. Right now, with your five senses, it's impossible. So the way to determine historical fact versus fiction is primarily through the eyewitness account. But you might ask me, how about video? If I have a video, we don't, but let's say of George, isn't that great? So how many people here, by a raise of hands, have ever heard of the term deep fake? If you're super into technology, you might have heard of it. Yeah, what do you think it is?
I heard it.
You haven't heard it?
Anybody? I have.
You don't know what it is? Deepfake is brand new technology that is extremely expensive still today, where they are able to perfectly fake a video. Not a cute fake of a video. Perfectly. There's a video that's out there of former President Barack Obama.
Oh, yeah.
Saying ridiculous things. I don't remember what he says, but just for argument's sake, I'll make it up. But it's as ridiculous as this. Like, Trump is the best president and he should be reelected and down with Biden. Whatever. Crazy things that Obama would never say. And it's perfect. The lip movements, the facial expressions, the voice. If you'd have a computer analyze the video, it would tell you a huge high accuracy percentage that it is a true video. Because of how advanced the technology is that manipulated and created that video. I believe, based on this technology, in general in technology, whatever costs like $100,000 today will cost maybe $10,000 in 2 or 3 years, maybe $5,000 or $1,000 in 5 or 6 years. So which means everyone's going to end up having access to this very powerful software and technology to completely fake videos perfectly. You won't be able to use video evidence in courts anymore. Because if you show me security camera footage of this, maybe it was faked. Maybe it was totally created. You could put someone else's... If Reuben's accused of murder, Reuben could come to court and Reuben could say, look, Shimon's the one killing him. Look at the video. We can't trust it anymore. So even video is not detecting history with your five senses. Certainly pictures and paintings and photographs and all that. So the only thing we have, or the strongest thing we have besides for artifacts that help, is how many eyewitnesses do we have? And even in a court of law, if we want to know 2 weeks ago of history, did Reuben kill Shimon in that building over there? We will find, are there eyewitnesses? That's the greatest source of proof to determine that it's a historical fact. Yes, indeed, Reuben killed Shimon. We will not look for an envelope with his name and say, oh, there's an envelope with Reuben's name in the building where Shimon got killed. Must be Reuben. It can help the case, but the eyewitness, and just one, not as good, multiple eyewitness accounts is how we would establish fact of history. That's step one. Yeah.
Technically, someone can hack the video and see if it's fake. Right now, but like 10 years from now, it should probably make better one.
Though. Right. It's always going to be a race between the two sides of technology. The point is it's going to be very iffy just because you could show a video in a court, in a courtroom. Right, very good, yeah.
There's a case like that now. It's going on now, like a murder trial, or like, it just finished.
How do you know about that?
My father was in CNN. And
okay.
I live back here.
Yeah. Okay. So, now let's talk and bring it back around. Some of you might know exactly where I'm going with this, and Rabbi Spira was already touching on this with his question. The Ramban tells us that the Shorish of our Amuna is Maimon Har Sinai. How many people stood at the foot of the mountain? We have 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 60. Another approximately 600,000 women, we would assume, of that age. Then a whole bunch more people over the age of 60, men and women. Whole bunch of people under the age of 20, boys and girls. So 1.2 million between those ages, probably another at least 800,000. So at least 2 million people stood by the foot of the mountain when what happened? The Ribono Shel Olam showed himself to all the people. Not to Moshe Rabbeinu, to all the people. All 2 million people experienced directly God. They also heard directly Hashem choosing Moshe as the Navi and giving the Torah through Moshe to Bnei Yisrael.
Did they hear the voice of Hashem?
They heard the voice of Hashem. We don't know what that means because we can't understand God at all. So however Hashem manifested himself to allow human beings to experience him, that
what happened when we heard the sound of the voice of Hashem?
They'll die.
There are midrashim that talk about dying and coming back to life and all that. But burned into our collective memory, those 2 million people all said to their children at the foot of Har Sinai, we witnessed God. All of us. Not someone told us about what God said. Not someone told us that they witnessed God. We all witnessed God. Now, when we want to determine historical fact from fiction, we look for multiple eyewitness accounts. In this case, we have 2 million eyewitness accounts being passed down from generation to generation, from father to son, father to son, father to son to this day. Not only that, we were split up for many hundreds of years. Sfaradim and Ashkenazim and opposite sides of the earth. We've come back together in today's day and age, Baruch Hashem. And we all have that same story, that same eyewitness account passed down father to son, father to son. Now I'm going to talk about a few questions, so tell me if I address your questions. If I don't, then I'll call on your questions, okay? Here's a few obvious questions. You need to go to that thing? Yeah. Here's a few obvious questions. Number one, it's very nice that we use historical fact for George Washington from 250 years ago. We use eyewitness accounts. But this is 3,300 years ago. There's a big difference between 250 years and 3,000 years. There is a difference. But is it a big difference? How many times does that story have to get passed down from only 250 years ago? Maybe, let's say, twice. Three times. How many times from Har Sinai? 3,000? I think Rabbi Barrow Wine works it out. About 25 or 26 times. In the 20s. Is how many times it would have to get passed down. Rabbi Yaakov Schwartz was at one of these presentations I just gave in another shir. He said, I don't remember the names he said, he has a grandfather who was born in the 1870s, Rabbi Yaakov Schwartz. That grandfather studied by Rav Spector, and Rav Spector was a Talmud of the Gra, I think. So, two steps for Rabbi Yaakov Schwartz. Maybe I'm messing up the names. I'll clarify the names of Rabbi Schwartz. The point is, it's two steps. Rabbi to Talmud, that he already, Rabbi Yaakov Schwartz, is connected to the Gra from 300 years ago, from the 1700s. Okay? So, when you go back and you connect grandfather to grandson and those types of connections, it can be 25 around steps to go back to Maimon Har Sinai itself. So, first of all, it's not like, wow, the message has to get passed so many times. Now you might say, okay, but even 25 times. There's the game of telephone. Things get messed up when you transfer message to message. You guys know the game of telephone? But you know what the main key word... Can you do that as after?
No,
I'm
saying
off what I'm saying right now?
No, it's exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's how Sephardim know what Tchilas is. Because
it's
passed from generation to generation.
They still have that.
They get messed up.
Okay, so we're not going to get into how Machlokas came to be. It's an excellent question, and I'm happy to come back and give another class on it. There's a whole big presentation on that.
Also, one more.
But one second. The idea here is that the key word of the game of telephone is game. Rabbi Lawrence Kellerman did an experiment where he went into a large auditorium with many people to play the game of telephone. And naturally, it got all messed up. The message was messed up at the end. Then he offered each person $100 if they get it right. Just $100. It's not a lot of money. It's a lot of money for him if you have to pay it to all people. But it's a nice amount. They all got it right. What do you know? If there was a fire on one side of the room and the phone was on the other side of the room and you needed to pass the message, you couldn't scream it out, to get the fire department to come and save you, you'd get that phone number perfectly right passing. Wait, tell me that number again? Okay, one second, let me just get it right. You'd get it right. Because it matters. The game of telephone is not a kasha on Masorah in general. It's a game. That's why it gets messed up. Otherwise, it does not get messed up when it's a message of importance. This is eyewitness account that was passed up on down, generation to generation, 20-something times to us today, that our ancestors stood at the foot of that mountain witnessing eyewitness account. And this is how we always determine historical fact from fiction, that there's a Ribono Shel Olam and that he gave us the Torah. That's number one. Number two, is it really 3,000 years? How many people here have ever heard of the document called the Septuagint? Anybody? Septuagint.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You might be aware of it from a Gemara. The Gemara tells us that in Greek times, the emperor had 70 chachamim sit in 70 different rooms, and they all had to translate the Torah into Greek. They made a few, the Gemara tells us, they made a few insignificant changes, changes that don't change the whole meaning of the Jewish people are the chosen people, we got the Torah, we, there's a Ribono Shel Olam. Few insignificant, like for example, one change was they didn't keep the word Arneves, and it was miraculous that they all made the same changes because they couldn't communicate with each other. They didn't keep the word Arneves as referring to some sort of rat or rodent in the Torah because the emperor's wife happened to be named Arneves. So they didn't want the emperor to read the new translation of the Torah into Greek and see, you're calling my wife a rat? Or maybe a cockroach? They didn't want that. So they changed these insignificant changing orders around a little bit, took these names, but otherwise, that was the translation of the Torah. And in those days, you know how long ago that was? About 2,300 years ago. In those days, it was a universally accepted document world over. Greek was like the English of today. Because everyone spoke it. It was the language of the empire. The whole world accepted this document as, yes, this is what the Jewish document. They received the Torah. There's a Ribono Shel Olam, all spread out to that day 2,300 years ago. Which means we now only need 1,000 years for that eyewitness account to be passed down until that day when everyone accepted that was agreed upon the translation of the Torah. This is all without even getting into the amazing authenticity that the Torah, the written Torah itself provides for us. We'll get to that later. This is just simply an analysis of history. Whenever we determine what was the name of that Caesar, we're not just doing it based on, oh, we had an artifact, we did something in archaeology. We're doing it based on the fact that it was passed down. That we have history ideas passed down. We have people who wrote notes and gave those notes to the next generation. And everyone passed the message down, multiple branches, so we know what happened in history. It is always the best way to determine historical fact from fiction. Why should what happened to the Jewish people be any different? It's how we would determine even things about Greek and Roman times from thousands of years ago. It's certainly how we determine more recent history from hundreds of years ago. And if it's only 1,000 years back, it's like, was there ever a man named Rashi? Not just from his writings. We have a Masorah. People have seen him and have passed that down generation to generation to this day of people who knew that there was a Rashi, who spoke of interacting with him. That's always how we determine historical fact from fiction, and the same thing applies here. It's a very powerful idea that gives a platform for Emunah, that there in fact is a Ribono Shel Olam, that he gave us the Torah at Har Sinai, and that we're the chosen people. Now, if we just branch out to Rabbi Spiro's question for a second, which is, okay, that's good for the things we have eyewitness accounts of, but what about the things we don't? We don't know whether Avraham Avinu in private went and smashed idols. That was the question. The answer is, once we have a God-given Torah, and that's not just the Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah he gave to us. It's the Torah Shebaal Peh as well, that we know that he gave to Moshe Rabbeinu orally. Once we have and we witness, there's a Ribono Shel Olam. He created the world. Here he is. He gave the nation this Torah. So then we trust that the whole thing is true based on that. So every little detail, Rabbi Spiro, that ever happened from knowing it from the Torah has the same level of authenticity and that validity as the Torah itself, which we receive directly from the Ribono Shel Olam. It's all built on the fact that we directly experience it. It's not built on the eyewitness account of Avraham Avinu, that he existed. It's built on the eyewitness account of our collective mass revelation, eyewitness account of Matan Torah. Once we establish that through historical analysis as fact, everything else from the Torah flows as we would accept it as true, because here is this true document we received directly from God. So there's an oral Torah as well that was given to Moshe. So you can ask, in general, how do we trust anything about the oral Torah? So let's think about that. The Ribbono Shalom reveals himself at the mountain. He gives Moshe Rabbeinu. We hear him choosing Moshe Rabbeinu as a Navi and giving the first two commandments directly. We hear it from God, not from Moshe, from God. So we see this is all happening. Now Moshe Rabbeinu, let's just say, Chas v'Shalom, says, let me make up some stuff. What's going to happen? Ribbono Shalom is going to say, okay, go make up some stuff. We'll get to that in a second. Okay, go make up some stuff. Ribbono Shalom is going to say, 1 second, no, that's not right. We saw and heard Hashem saying, Moshe's the Ish Ne'eman, trust him. He's giving you the Torah. Once we have that witnessing of God himself, trusting and directing Moshe to give us the Torah, what more do you need in terms of the trustworthiness of everything that's written in the Torah and everything that's spoken from Moshe orally, that Moshe is saying God told him to tell us?
Does everyone accept that Hashem spoke to the Jewish people at Har Sinai?
That's a great question. It's exactly the next step of the presentation, but we have a very urgent question.
All the Neshamas from years past.
Yes. That's excellent. In fact, from a Ruchniyistika perspective, I can't really explain it to you with words, but with emotions maybe, and certainly spiritually, we all have a connection to Amunah that surpasses any logical analysis or explanation. But it goes back to that feeling of Amunah Pshuta. You just look out and it's so obvious. I believe there is an interplay between the Neshama, the Ruchnius, the Pshita of the Amunah. And again, for those who have it strongly within them, you don't need any of this. This can strengthen your Amunah, but you don't need it. But for those who don't feel that very strongly, from that spiritual part of themselves, this is important. That's an excellent addition, yeah.
And also, like, for all these things, like when Avram like broke all the aisles, somebody probably was walking into the shop and saw Avram with one of
the baseball bat. But the Torah definitely sometimes tells us things. Yeah, no, the Torah definitely sometimes tells us things that only Hashem would know. For example, in the Megillah we have, that Haman thought in his heart.
Like foreshadowing.
How do we know that Haman thought in his heart? What? The Gemara says, because Hashem knows what Haman thought in his heart. Yeah. So, you can't always trace it back to everything has an eyewitness account, but this mass revelation does millions of people big, and everything else flows from it. Because if Hashem exists, and the Torah is true, and there's clearly a Torah Sheba'al Peh, how do we know even from the Torah Sheba'al Peh itself that there was a Torah Sheba'al Peh? Hashem says, just one small example, there are lots of examples. Hashem says to Moshe, Shech, as I have commanded you. Nowhere in the Torah does it write how to shech. Do you knock the animal on the head? Do you cut its limbs off and drain the blood out? What do you do? It doesn't say anywhere. The answer is, Hashem told him orally. That was part of the oral Torah. How to shech an animal. So the point is, once we have that eyewitness account, everything else flows from the simple analysis that we would do with any historical event. Do we have a substantial eyewitness account story or not? Now, going into Rabbi Spiro's question, let's take a look at the other religions. And by the way, this argument opposes all other religions as well as atheism. Because an atheist will say, that never happened. And here we have the evidence that it in fact did happen based on the regular historical analysis we would ever do. Now, what are the religions that we find around us in the Western world? There are two main religions around us in the Western world. Christianity and Islam, right. Both the Christians and the Muslims, each billions of people large, believe the Ribbono Shel Olam was at Har Sinai. Klal Yisrael experienced the Ribbono Shel Olam at Har Sinai. We're given the Torah. with a public eyewitness display for millions of people who directly witnessed it. And then hundreds of years later, came around Yashka, came around Christianity, or his disciples, Paul and others, and Hashem whispered, actually, the religion's changing now. And this didn't happen right away, but eventually, Shabbos is now on Sunday, not Saturday. Pretty big change, amongst many other changes. New religion, and we'll call it Christianity. Now, if I was Yashka or Paul, I'd say to God, no problem. You want to change your religion, God? You could do whatever you want. It says in the Torah, this Torah will never change. But you can do whatever you want. You want to change it? At the very least, make a new public display where you yourself show yourself. Show yourself publicly to millions of people, just like you did for Bnei Yisrael. Because you're changing everything. You're saying the Jewish people are not the chosen. So make a new mass eyewitness account. No such event. No such event. No one's claiming there's ever such event. No eyewitness story being passed down from generation to generation at all of that. In fact, all it is lots of people nowadays, billions, saying that their father told them, that their father told them, that their father told them, etc. That a man claims he spoke to God. That's all it goes back. It's billions of people large. Billions of people eventually bought into it. And how did that happen? When you convince the emperor, you'll get power if you buy into my religion. And now the army comes, and the army pressures people to... And then you find in Spain, even with the Muranos. You guys know what the Muranos are? I'm going to make the distinction in 1 second. Right? In the Muranos in Spain, they still believed in their heart that Judaism was true, but they were forced by the strength of the government not to practice it at all. And most of the practicing just wasn't done. You know what happens 2-3 generations later? It just gets completely forgotten if you can't practice it. That's what happens. So you have the armies coming and forcing large country, and therefore you end up with billions of people buying into either one, let's say Christianity or Islam. The bottom line is that their story, listen very carefully, is my father told me that his father told him, that his father told him, etc., that a man said, God spoke to me, and I am now the God or the prophet, and this is the new religion. Judaism is my father told me, that his father told him, that his father told him, etc., going all the way back, that he, and then in that family, he, and in that family, he, all witnessed God directly choosing them and choosing Moshe Rabbeinu as the prophet and giving them the Torah. That is a huge difference. Between, despite all of it being our fathers told us that his father told him, it is a huge difference in terms of what's the haskalah. What does it bring you back to? In our case, a mass eyewitness account of God. In their case, Yashka or Paul coming and making a claim. In the case of Islam, even worse, Muhammad coming down from a mountain saying, none of you were anywhere near me, I was on the top of the mountain by myself. God spoke to me quietly and told me to come down and say, I'm the new prophet. So it is a huge difference. Do you understand that difference?
Yes, but you could say, I mean, you could really say the same thing like here. Maybe a guy pulled shtick and was
Maybe. Okay, we're going to get into the maybes in a second. We're going to get into the maybes in a second. That's a new question. For now, let's just understand the difference that I just articulated. One is the Mesorah, father to son, going back. That there was this mass eyewitness account, all the people saw it themselves. One second. We can't ask two questions at the same time. I only can answer one at a time. So just first is this distinction. I'm going to get to your question without thinking about the shtick piece yet. I'm going to get there. That's our story, mass eyewitness account. The other stories are one man's claim. So even if you have billions of people saying it's true now, it still only rests on the credibility of one man's claim, whereas by us it rests on the credibility of a huge mass eyewitness claim. Okay, I'm going to get to your question. I see it's really bothering you. I see it's super bothering you, but I have other questions. I want to just quickly get to theirs, and I'm going to come right back to your question, okay? Because the next step of the presentation, yeah. What?
Yeah, sure.
I still don't get why if it goes from etc. to a person claiming God spoke to him, why is everyone believing him?
There are many reasons why people believe people. Sometimes it's because They're powerful. Sometimes they were forced. Sometimes they're very charismatic and they like the guy, so they choose to believe. It's not a kasha that people sometimes choose to believe. But you know what you'll never get the person to say if it didn't happen? I witnessed God. If you didn't. If you really didn't witness God, you're never going to end up with the story of I witnessed God. Because that's not what happened. You could end up with the story of he said to me, he spoke to God, and this is his prophecy, and I'm choosing to believe it. But the story then is, he's making a claim. Not I, and him, 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 2 million, witnessed God. Okay, that's a sociological question. That's a sociological question. And there are a lot of armies that came to fight those armies to promote him. Especially because they would be put into power. That's what happened if you look at history. Okay, getting back to your question. There's always a maybe. For example, isn't there a maybe George Washington doesn't exist? It's a very, very, very small chance, but isn't there a maybe? You know what? That brings me to my other thing that I do with a lot of my time. I don't know if you know this, but I actually treat people psychologically. It's called therapy, psychotherapy. There's a name for the person who's worried about every single little maybe, no matter how improbable it is. It's called OCD, which stands for obsessive compulsive disorder, and it's very sad. It's very sad. It's an illness. Baruch Hashem, it's treatable, sometimes with medicine, with the therapy and the ideas that I do with them. It can be treatable, but it's a sad illness. For example, here's what someone with OCD sometimes could look like. It's late at night. They want to finally go to sleep. They lay down in bed, but they think to themselves, did I lock the front door? Let me go check. They get out of bed. It's locked. Okay, finally, I'm going to sleep. It's already past midnight. Did I for sure lock the door? Let me just go check one more time. Yes. All right, it's already 12:30. I can't fall asleep. Maybe I blinked. Maybe I didn't see so clearly. Let me just go check. On and on and on and on, and it ruins their lives. And that's just one example of what someone with OCD could struggle with.
On your main presentation, please give an example of a religious...
There are religious ones, too.
Please give one. I think it's important.
Okay, let's say somebody...
I know it's not your main presentation, but
that's okay, that's okay. Let's flush this out a little bit more. Let's say somebody is davening. And in the middle of davening, they think to themselves, when I say Shema, I need to make sure that I said the words clearly and that I had Kavanah. Now, the Ribbono Shel Olam does not want us to be angels. He did not create us to be angels. So he expects us, when we're supposed to have Kavanah and say words, to say them like any average human being would say them, and to at least have Kavanah like any average human being would have Kavanah. Now, this person who has OCD might think to himself like this. Shema Yisrael, but paying attention. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. He's ready to go on to Baruch Shem. And he's like, wait, I'm not so sure I had the right Kavanah. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Ready to go on to Baruch Shem. Wait. Maybe I didn't pronounce Shema right. Just in case. Shema, 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 Shema. Shema. And he's trying to figure it out.
It's not funny. It's not funny, but it's very, very, very sad.
It's a sad illness. That the people come to people like me to help them break out of this illness. That is exactly what it is. Just like a person could have a cold, you'd call that a physical illness. So to mentally, that just means the brain and your emotions, your psyche, you can have an illness as well. And when a person struggles with that, they must go seek professional help. There are all sorts of areas in religion where that can come out. We're not going to get into all the different examples, but you can imagine. You can imagine. So that is what we would call such a person. Imagine I decide I want to walk this way, but maybe that tile over there is a portal to another dimension and I'll get sucked in and never return.
That is not.
Well, I could check. Nope, it's safe. Yeah, but what about that tile and that tile and that tile? It never ends. Ain, what we call ain l'dabar sof. When a person struggles with OCD, they worry about every single last little tiny possibility. So, whenever you have eyewitness accounts, You could always say, but maybe. Let's say you have 50 witnesses see Reuven kill Shimon. Maybe all 50 of them are mistaken. Maybe they didn't see it accurately, but they were all standing different angles. Maybe they all made the same mistake. Maybe. We would say in a court of law, he goes to jail for the rest of his life. That's enough to convict him. Because it's extremely likely to be true. So what I'm presenting to you, whenever we talk about historical fact, is not a proof Judaism is right, as if I'm touching this table right now. It's a tremendous credibility advantage, a piece of logic and reasoning that shows how likely it is to be right. That's all I'm coming to establish here. Same way that we would convict a person on murder charges if there were 50 witnesses. And by the way, anybody who doesn't want to believe it can say, I don't want to believe it. Because it's not like it's right here in front of you. Let me go back to my murder case. 50 witnesses say Reuven killed Shimon. So Reuven's about to get the death penalty. Reuven's mother, or Reuven himself, are they going to say, well, 50 people, so they're going to say they're liars. Reuven's mother's going to say those 50 people are all lying. Maybe they were bribed. Listen carefully. This is for you. Listen carefully. Maybe it was a magic trick. Maybe it was an hallucination. Maybe they did drugs. Maybe they got a lot of money to say the lie. That's what the mother's going to say. That's what
he's
the mother's
going to say. He's not moving. He's pale. He's looking for pale.
No, 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 no.
He's not moving.
No,
he's not breathing.
The witnesses are saying they saw Reuven as the one who pulled the trigger. So she's saying, you didn't see Reuven. You saw some other guy, but it wasn't Reuven who pulled the trigger. Because maybe it was magic. Maybe it was this. Maybe it was that. Because you don't want to believe it. It means that your child is going to go to jail or get the death penalty. So you'll say anything you can to deny it. And you can because it's historical analysis. It's not a proof like this desk exists right in front of me right now. It's the same thing here. Historical analysis suggests that the eyewitness account gives us the true version of the facts. But maybe, that rises to the level of OCD. That rises to the level of, I have some reason why I want to deny it, and therefore I'm going to deny it. We would never say such a thing about something that doesn't affect me. Maybe there was no such person as George Washington who fought in the Revolutionary War. Maybe the people who say they saw him hallucinated. What? That's crazy. It's a historical fact because of the eyewitness account. So that's the basic idea that I want to present to you today. We branched off and took care of a lot of the questions that can be asked on it. There are still more questions, and if there are more questions, I'm happy to have them written down, and I'll come back and I'll answer those questions. If you have a bunch of questions for me to come back and present on, I'm also happy to present on other topics. If we want to go more into, let's say, if you're interested in OCD and things like that. But just for now, are there any other questions on what I spoke about today so far?
No.
Okay.